Didn't recover in 231. So. All right, I started.
All right, so this is Bio 241. This is the last lecture before your test on Tuesday. And it's September 8th, and we're going to finish up chapter, we're going to finish up which chapter today? Chapter 3, right, so it's cell structure and genetic control, and we're talking about genetic control. We're pretty much through all the cell structures, so we've got to cover a couple of things that just to time in with genetic control a little bit, like a ribosome and that kind of thing. All right, so we see mammalian cell. All right, so some people really want to listen to lecture, you guys, so yeah, so I know there's other important stuff going on, but you might want to just step out in the hallway, okay, because some people really do like to listen. But I can turn this up, but I don't want to, like, get feedback and shatter everybody's eardrum either, so. All right, so you learned a bunch of organelles. So you got to know organelles for the test by their shape, you got to know their name, and you have to know their function. And don't forget, the test is just going to be photocopied in grayscale. It's not going to be in color. So if you've memorized organelles by whatever color they are in your textbook, that won't help you out. So know whether it's a membrane-bound organelle or not a membrane-bound organelle, and know at least one bullet point word, at least one word what it does. Like, for instance, flagella or flagellum. Well, what are you going to say? Motility, right? Because that's how we talked about it in class. So each of those. Now, Golgi apparatus might be a little bit different because it has two main functions. Anybody remember? Packaging is number one, and modification. It can modify proteins. It can convert them into something else and package them, right? So try to remember at least one bullet point for each of those organelles. Now, I wish for you to tell me, why do our cells, human cells, have all these organelles inside of them? What's the purpose of all these organelles? Do you have an idea? Oh yeah, get a sign-in sheet working too. Who can get a sign-in sheet? Yeah, each organelle has a function, and you learn the functions of these kinds of things. So that's important. Metabolism to maintain homeostasis. That's real important, homeostasis. Okay, but here's what I'm thinking. When you walk into this building, think this building is a cell, okay, just a cell, and let's just say there were no rooms in the building, and you could walk in, but there were chairs, so you could sit down, and you could listen to a physiology lecture, and a chemistry lecture, and a physics lecture, and a couple math lectures, all at the same time, okay, because it was just one big room. Now, that would be really nice, because you could graduate, right, with a double arts degree in what? Just one semester, because you could learn all that stuff all at the same time. Is that possible?
No.
Does that sound like you don't like my idea? It doesn't sound possible. Oh, why is that not possible?
Too many tests.
Too many tests, okay. But the reason why it's really impossible is because if I'm lecturing and there's five or six other instructors lecturing, how is the information being conveyed to you? It's just a jarble of words, right? You wouldn't be able to understand a thing. It would be a big waste of time, right? So why do we put different rooms in a building? So that different kinds of specialized functions can take place at what? The exact same time without interference from each other. So that's why a cell has organelles, so that the cell can make a lot of ATP, but that function doesn't interfere with protein synthesis, or it doesn't interfere with modification and packaging of certain kinds of molecules, right? So organelles are there for specialized functions, but more importantly, so that those functions don't interfere with other important functions that are taking place in the cell at the exact same time. And that's what you need, all these things happening together to maintain what? Homeostasis. That's why I really like that word, homeostasis. So that's why we had to learn about all these different kinds of organelles. Okay, so here we were talking about RNA synthesis, and on this slide I see some DNA and I see some RNA, and you should be able to pick out where the DNA is and where the RNA is by a couple reasons. Okay, maybe just the shape of the molecule. By shape, what does DNA look like? A double strand, and RNA is just a single strand. So I see a nice double strand right here, so we know this is DNA. Okay, so forget that it's labeled. And then over here is just a single strand. And it's clearly labeled RNA, but you should know why that's RNA, because it's a single strand. But another reason is because of the bases that we find in these different molecules. For instance, the base pairs that we see in DNA are what? GC and AT. But in RNA, that thymine is going to be replaced with uracil. So if we look at this strand over here, you're going to look for thymines or uracils, and what do you find? Uracil, so voila, that's not a DNA molecule. Okay, so the other thing that you should know about this slide right here is that what is the enzyme that is using this big polymer of nucleotides in DNA to make this long polymer of nucleotides in RNA? There's an enzyme that does that. Yeah, polymerase. Ah, but what kind of polymerase? There's all kinds of polymerases. RNA polymerase, because it's making RNA and using the DNA as a template to make this particular sequence. And look, the primary sequence of RNA matches up beautifully with the primary sequence or the primary structure of the DNA molecule, with the exception that for in RNA you got to substitute a uracil right here. All right, so RNA polymerase makes RNA. And what's the chemical reaction that's used to take these separate nucleotides and make a big polymer out of it? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So it's just basically that same kind of reaction. The other kind of cool thing that happens here is that the RNA polymerase has to unzip and unwind the DNA molecule. Okay, but on this slide it also shows you, remember there are two kinds of DNA. You can have condensed chromatin or you can have extended chromatin. And this step right here can only occur with extended chromatin. So if chromatin is condensed into a chromosome, then this step in protein synthesis cannot take place because it's too tightly packaged on those histone molecules, right? And you can't unzip a DNA molecule when it's packaged into a chromosome. All right, so how many steps are necessary for protein synthesis? Yeah, there's two steps, all right? And so you should know where they take place, what their names are. So what's the first step? Does it matter what the first step is or second step? Can the second step come before the first one? No, it's got to be a one-way street. First step first, second step second. What's the first step? Transcription. What's the second step? Translation. And so what step is this right here? This is clearly transcription. It's converting the information in DNA into what that primary structure, the primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA, which is transcription. And where does this always take place? In the nucleus, right? Because DNA never leaves the nucleus. All right, so transcription makes RNA. That's what we're talking about, RNA synthesis. And there are three main kinds of RNA. There's messenger RNA, and this contains the spelling of how we're going to put amino acids together with the help of a ribosome. All right, so sometimes we call that the message. All right, but in order for a ribosome to make a protein, what does it need? What are the building blocks of a protein? Amino acids, right? So a ribosome doesn't go out and get amino acids, it's delivered. There's a special delivery system, and that's by another kind of RNA molecule called transfer RNA. You could call it taxi RNA if you wanted to, but just these things just carry different amino acids, maybe 20 different amino acids to the ribosome so that they can be incorporated into a growing protein. And then the third kind right here is ribosomal RNA. This helps make up most of the parts of the ribosome, which is the workbench where a protein will be made. All right, so all these things are made inside the nucleus, and then they're actively transported out into the nucleus, into the cytoplasm, where the second step of protein synthesis takes place, which is called translation, because you're going from a nucleotide language into a what? Amino acid language, right? That's translation. All right, so here is a pretty interesting slide. Here we have DNA, right, double-stranded, and through that transcription process, we get a messenger RNA, and this is what we're going to call pre-messenger RNA. But eventually, it's going to give us a nice message to make a protein with. There are some segments that are very important that are used for translation, and there are other segments that are not used. The segments that are used for translation are called exons, and then these like little nonsense regions right here are called introns. And people are learning something about these introns, if they're useful for anything or not. And right now we have a pretty fuzzy understanding of them. All right? But what happens when you have a pre-messenger RNA, it can't be used to make a protein. these dark segments right here, what do we call these dark segments? These are introns, have to be cut out. So there are special splicing kinds of enzymes that work in complexes called spliceosomes that splice these introns out and then recombine the exons right here to make a competent RNA molecule which can be used to make a protein. So in this example, we see that this segment of pre-messenger RNA has three different segments, all right, and depending on how these segments are put together, okay, then different proteins can be made with this one gene. So this one gene from DNA has these three exons and two introns in it, but these exons can be combined in different ways to make different kinds of proteins, depending on what the cell is requiring. And I think you had a couple of questions at the end of the chapter in your study guide for this right here. All right, so the general thought years ago was that one gene would produce one protein. Okay, but now we understand, at least in complex eukaryotic cells like our human cells are made out of, right, one gene, which produces this pre-messenger RNA, can make a number of different proteins depending on how these different exons are either thrown away or spliced together, right, to make different kinds of proteins. So what did we call all the genes in your body? That's the genome, okay? And for very simple organisms, the genome exactly matches up what we call the proteome, which is what? All the proteins that your body can make. But in humans, because of splicing of these pre-messenger RNA molecules, it is possible for your body to make different proteins from just one gene, right? So the proteome is actually larger than the genome in nice complicated organisms like humans. All right, so the human genome has around 25,000 genes, right? So with the old theory, right, the old understanding of how that worked, then the human body should be able to make about 25,000 different kinds of proteins. But in fact, it produces over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. All right, so how could you explain that? Because when you get a messenger RNA, like what we have right here, right, one gene, in this example, even if we don't splice them together, can make, what, three different kinds of proteins. And then if this first exon and second exon are put together, that's even a fourth kind of protein that can be made, right, just all from this one gene. And by taking different exons and splicing them together in different ways, that's what we call alternative splicing, and that's a way to explain why the proteome is a lot greater than the genome in people. All right, so it's not so in very simple organisms like bacteria and things like that. But you have to have a nice eukaryotic cell that has organelles. So here we have an organelle. Here are some little ribosomes. And attached to a ribosome, this big, long filament right here, that's a messenger RNA molecule. And that's going to define how a protein is going to be built up. That will determine the spelling of that protein. And the spelling is what? The amino acids, how they're going to be added in the proper primary sequence to make a protein. Right, but notice these little dots right here are the ribosomes. And this is a nice electron micrograph, so we're at very high magnification. Can't see this with a light microscope. So we see one messenger RNA molecule with many ribosomes on them. So at one time, this one messenger RNA can make, what, many proteins, but all these proteins are going to be identical to each other, right, because the ribosome is following the instructions in the messenger RNA, and that's not changing. So whenever you have one strand of messenger RNA with, and it could have maybe 100 different ribosomes attached to it, all making the same kind of protein, we call that a polysome. So under these conditions, you could guess, right, this cell needs a lot of what? Needs a lot of whatever protein this is that's being made by this messenger RNA molecule. So here we see that the building of a protein is very early on, so these segments of the protein are very short, but over here, what's the length of protein? That's a lot longer, right? So these ribosomes actually move down the messenger RNA, and as they move down, this protein gets bigger and bigger and bigger because it adds what to the growing protein? More amino acids at each of these little steps right here. Okay, so here's a newly synthesized protein. So don't forget, here's a nice polysome. Oh, what else do I see in this? All right, so what part of the cell is this taking place? Where do you see ribosomes? in the cytoplasm, not inside the nucleus. Okay. So remember, how many steps is protein synthesis? It's two steps. Okay, yeah, two steps. You got what? Transcription is one. What's the second one? Translation. Right? And translation is what, according to the diagram? Conversion of what kind of information into another kind of information? RNA into a protein. So here we have RNA, and it's being, that information is being used to build this protein. So what is taking place right here? This is translation, right? So here is a nice molecular picture of translation, and where is it taking place? In the cytoplasm, okay? So translation. So that just helps you to understand some of those things. We're going to review these concepts with this slide right here. This is kind of one of the most amazing slides that you have in the book, okay? It's still, we're talking about protein synthesis, all right? But we got DNA in the first column, RNA in the second column, and then amino acids in the third. All right, and so this again, kind of think of this as a one-way street where you have a primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA, which is used to make a primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA, and you should be able to tell me that process. What's the name of that process that converts, you know, TAC into AUG in RNA? That's transcription. Where does that take place? In the nucleus, right? And then you have a nice messenger RNA molecule right here, and you got these bases, AUG. This is going to be converted into the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. AUG codes for methionine, but it's also the start signal, right? So all messenger RNAs have AUG at the beginning. It could have them in the middle someplace, but then it's going to code for this amino acid right here. So I see a bunch of amino acids in this third column. And then in the second column, it tells me what the three nucleotides are in messenger RNA that are going to put, for instance, proline in a growing protein in a particular location. And that's going to be what? Cytosine, cytosine, cytosine. So a basic question is, how many nucleotides does it take to code for a particular amino acid in a protein? It's going to take three, because remember, there's only four different nucleotides in RNA, which are what? Cytosine, uracil, guanine, and adenine. But how many different amino acids are there? There's about 20, maybe a couple more, right? So one base can't tell you what amino acid it is. Two is not enough. So you need a combination of three nucleotide bases to tell you what the proper amino acid is. So you got transcription, translation, right? The triplet code is always found in a messenger RNA molecule, like what we were looking at on the previous slide. And this triplet code, right, is what we call a codon. And we're going to see how that functions in the next couple of slides. So the codon is going to tell us what amino acid is going to be placed in a protein when it starts to grow. Now, here's the most amazing thing about this little chart right here. All right, this tells us the genetic code. Right, so for instance, if you have a triplet that's CGA, what in this location of the amino acid as it's growing, what amino as the protein is growing, what amino acid is going to be incorporated into the protein at this location? It's going to be arginine. Okay, and then if a ribosome runs into ACG, it knows to put what amino acid in on the protein that's growing? Threonine. All right, and this genetic code right here is, actually you should write it in, it's omitted from your book, it's the universal genetic code. And what that means is that all life forms on the planet use this kind of code to build a protein. So that's pretty amazing. So what is that? That's evidence for something. That's very powerful evidence for evolution, right? It can't prove that evolution takes place. I mean, if you're somebody that really believes in like a creation theory, well, you could say, well, you know, God defined what this code should be. It didn't happen by evolution, and so it's not proof of evolution. It's just what some evidence that supports that it takes place at a really nice molecular level. All right, so here is something that's similar to the previous slides that we've looked at. When you look at this slide, probably an exam figure, what should you see right off the bat? How about DNA? Do you see DNA right here? Yeah, I see a nice double strand. I also see some thymines in here, so I know that this is DNA. All right, and in order for protein synthesis to take place, what has to happen to this DNA double helix? It's got to open up. Is that a big deal? No big deal, because you have hydrogen bonds between cytosine, right, and guanine, and between thymine and adenine. It's easy to unzip the molecule, and then when you're done, zip it back up. All right, but remember, this has to be extended chromatin, cannot be condensed, right, because condensed chromatin can't be unzipped at all because it's packaged with those proteins, those histone molecules. So it's unzipped. So here is one strand of the DNA. So not both strands, when you unzip a DNA molecule, not both strands are used for, what is that process of making RNA from DNA? Transcription. So not both strands are transcribed, only one is. We call that the sense strand, and the other is the nonsense strand. We'll probably figure out or realize or discover what the nonsense strand is there for. It probably has some uses somewhere down the line. We'll figure that out. So here's the sense strand in DNA. Okay, and what do you need to make a messenger RNA from the sense strand of DNA? What's the enzyme? You need RNA polymerase, right, that will take these different RNA nucleotides and base pair them with the DNA nucleotides right here. And remember, when transcription is taking place, you can't cut the strand of DNA. Because if you cut the strand of DNA, then you don't know how to put these different codons in the right order, right? So it's got to be a nice controlled process. So here is the messenger RNA that's being made. And what is the start signal for translation? It's going to be AUG, and we got it right here, right? So this part is going to be important. Start signal for a ribosome to attach in this location, right? So when we have these signals in a messenger RNA, the sequence of three nucleotides is what we call a codon, okay? And so what's the second codon? GGC. That's going to code for a particular amino acid to be placed next to methionine, because AGU is not only the start signal, but it puts a methionine right here. So what is a ribosome going to do when it sees GGC? Is it on the previous slide? Do we see a GGC? GGC. Oh, glycine. Ooh, is that what it's asking for? Did we do that right? Glycine. Ah, okay. That's how it should always work, right? So now you're starting to make this protein right here. So the two steps are converting information in DNA into RNA. That's transcription, right? It happens inside the nucleus. What is this step called? Going from the messenger RNA using these triplet codes, these codons in messenger RNA, to insert these various amino acids in the proper order. That's translation, right? That happens inside the cytoplasm. Okay, so I don't know if you looked at this slide before class. Maybe so. Is this an exam figure? I can't remember if it is or not. Might not be, huh? So maybe you didn't look at it before class. But anyway, I want to ask you, who's got a question about this slide? Because it's kind of cool. It shows you transcription, translation. It shows you the triplet code. And how we define the triplet code in messenger RNA is what we call a codon. Okay? And this codon right here can base pair with other RNA molecules. And the triplets in other RNA molecules are what we're going to call an anticodon. So we do have to look at that maybe on the next slide. But before we leave this slide, who's got a question about this slide right here? Okay, might have to look at it a couple times. But clearly you see what? DNA. And it can be witnessed a number of different ways, double strands, thymine. All right, and this is RNA right here. Right, because I don't see any thymines, and then each one of these triplet codes can be used to determine or to define what amino acid is built in this protein as it's being made, one amino acid at a time. So first it starts with a methionine, ribosome moves down to the next triplet code, builds the protein with a glycine, moves down again, okay, then it inserts a serine, and this slide right here, you can actually see the ribosome moving down that messenger RNA looking for the next triplet code, right, to insert an amino acid in this growing protein that is being built. And what's the code that's used? The universal genetic code right here. You don't have to memorize this code. I don't even know if I have any questions on the test using the code, but probably, I don't know, if there's a question at the end of the book, in the end of the chapter or on the online questions, that then you should probably know something about that. Okay, but you certainly don't need to memorize the universal genetic code. Okay, so a ribosome needs amino acids to build a protein. And what did we say? What brings amino acids to a ribosome? It's a special RNA molecule. It's what? That taxi RNA, the tRNA molecule. And it looks something like this. Right? You can go on the internet and get some really nice three-dimensional views of what this thing is. You can turn it around and look at it. But this has two ends. This end up over here is a place where an amino acid binds to the transfer RNA. This end over here can base pair very nicely with the messenger RNA. How will it base pair? How does it know how to base pair properly? Because uracil can only bind to adenine. So we get the codon on a messenger RNA is going to be what? AAU. And then this transfer RNA can bring in this particular amino acid to a ribosome to be made into a protein. And not any other kind of transfer RNA. So the anticodon is found in the transfer RNA. Where do you find the codon? The codon is found in the messenger RNA, and they're going to base pair just by the general base pairing rules that you're familiar with. Okay, so here is a little bit better graphic of how that happens. So here are some ribosomal RNA molecules that are put together to make a protein. Also requires to make a ribosome, but the ribosomal RNA also needs some protein molecules to form. And it can't form unless there's a messenger RNA that goes right through that little tunnel of the ribosome. You saw the picture of the tunnel before. And the ribosome is just big enough to reveal a couple triplets, a couple codons. All right, so, and then this thing is going to move down the messenger RNA. When a codon is revealed, a transfer RNA is going to move into this site right here. And how come... What kind of transfer RNAs can move into this location right here? What's that going to be determined by? It has to base pair, right? So the anticodon on the transfer RNA has to base pair with the codon on the messenger RNA, and if it doesn't, then it won't bring this little amino acid into the ribosome so that, what kind of bond is being formed right here? You had to draw that out in lab. Ah, that's a peptide bond, okay? Because what did we say? What did we say this was right here? Amino acid. You have a picture of what amino acid looks like in your mind? It's got an amino group, carboxyl group, right? And these things are in nice proximity to each other. So now that's a nice dehydration synthesis reaction can take place to make a nice peptide bond. And when that peptide bond is formed, then the ribosome is going to move over to the next triplet code, allowing the next transfer RNA to enter with its particular amino acid, okay, and then another peptide bond is going to form, and then the ribosome is going to move down to the next triplet code right here, and the protein will get bigger and bigger and bigger, one amino acid at a time, until it reaches a stop codon, in which time then the ribosome dissociates, releases the messenger RNA, and this protein is free to move around wherever it is. It could be in the cytosol or it could be in the endoplasmic reticulum. If it's what kind of endoplasmic reticulum? What kind can make a protein? Rough. And because rough ER has what? These little gizmos attached to them. So that the protein actually gets built and placed inside of the endoplasmic reticulum. Sometimes we call that just a cisternae. All right, so functions of the endoplasmic reticulum. Here is some rough ER, and you can see the protein that's being made and secreted into the cisterna of the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, what is going to be the fate of this protein right here that's inside a rough ER? Is it going to float around inside the cytosol? No, it's for excretion, or maybe it will be trapped inside a vesicle, like, for instance, a lysosome, or a peroxisome, so it will never be free to float around inside the cytosol. What kind of apparatus will make a protein that's free to float around in the cytosol? We call that a free ribosome, just one that's floating around in the cytosol. Creates a protein that stays in the cytosol. All right, don't forget your book calls rough endoplasmic reticulum granular. That's not a very common way of talking about it. Okay, after proteins are made by rough ER. Let's go back previous slide. So here's a protein that's in the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Maybe it needs to be modified before it's secreted. Who does that? The Golgi apparatus does, right? So the proteins are carried by a vesicle from rough endoplasmic reticulum to a Golgi apparatus. They fuse together, and then the proteins can be conjugated with carbohydrates or lipids. That means that a lipid molecule or a carbohydrate can be added to that protein, right, making a mucopolysaccharide or a lipoprotein. And then, like mucus, which is excreted outside the cell, is what we call a mucopolysaccharide. And so it's part protein, part sugar, and then it is what, exocytosed onto the surface of the epithelium. All right, but don't forget, some proteins stay inside the cell, inside vesicles, like lysosomes. What are the three kinds of vesicles that we talked about in here? Two, I'm sure you won't forget about. One, I'm concerned that you might forget about. So lysosome for what? What's the function? Digestion. Then we've got peroxisome for detoxification. And then the third one, we're going to talk about a lot later on. We just briefly touched on it. It's called an endosome. What's the job of an endosome? Yeah, so it's not so important what's inside the endosome, but what's actually placed in the membrane of the endosome, right? There are special proteins in the membrane of an endosome that can be plunked into the cell membrane, right, to give the cell membrane different activity because you're changing the shape of it, or an endosome can take those proteins out of the plasma membrane and sequester them inside the cell, changing the function of the plasma membrane very rapidly without having to go through that whole step of transcription, translation to make those new proteins. So an endosome is important for routing of membrane components. So routing is an important function. Okay, DNA replication. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Yeah, it's a cell, right? So it's a cell. In order for something to be alive, it has to be made out of a cell. What the heck is a cell again? It's got a couple things. It's got cytoplasm. I like that. It's got to have cytoplasm. It's a living junk inside the cell. It's got to have organelles. That's cytoplasm. Organelles So cytoplasm is what? Organelles plus cytosol. So we kind of covered that already. Organelles is cytoplasm. What else does the cell have to have? Genetic material, which we've been talking about. What's your favorite form of genetic material? DNA is pretty good. Okay, DNA is a good example. So it's got to have cytoplasm and DNA. And what other thing? Something to separate it from all that non-living commercials on the outside, right? What's that? That's the cell membrane, right? So a living cell's got a cell membrane, genetic material, and cytoplasm. Okay. And where do cells come from? Only other living cells. Okay, so that's really the cell theory and the understanding of how a cell is a building block of life. All right, so if living cells only come from other living cells, then that genetic material has to, what we call, replicate itself, so that both cells, after reproduction, have the genetic material. Otherwise, it's not going to be a living cell. So when cells divide, DNA replicates itself, and identical copies go to two daughter cells. Okay, so daughter cells occur through a process of mitosis, which is the very last chapter in this, or the very last topic in this chapter. All right, so but let's talk about DNA replication. So what kind of enzyme do you need to make RNA? RNA polymerase. In order to make DNA, what kind of enzyme do you need? You need DNA polymerase. Right? And what are the building blocks of DNA? Yeah, deoxyribonucleotides in particular. And how does your cell put these deoxyribonucleotides together? What kind of chemical reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? And the enzyme that does that is DNA polymerase. So it's a little bit different kind of enzyme, probably very similar to RNA polymerase, probably cousin molecules, probably look very similar. All right, but there's also a molecule called a helicase that's necessary to unwind the DNA molecule when it unzips. That's a little bit different compared to RNA polymerase. And using these general base pairing rules that we're familiar with, Each strand of a DNA molecule will act as a template for making another strand of DNA. We call this a semi-conservative process for replication. So replication is like being a process of duplicating the DNA inside of a cell. All right. All of the original DNA sequence is preserved. So let's take a look and see how all these situations can be obeyed all at the same time. All right, so if the original DNA sequence is preserved, that's almost a little freaky. Because what is that to me? I think way back when, the very first cell, that DNA molecule is still around in somebody over here. Who's got it? I don't know who's got it. Or one of you got it. Or somebody's got the original caveman DNA in you. I'm not sure, but it's still kind of around. There's some exceptions to that that we can think of. But let's take a look at how DNA replication takes place. Now, how do you know this is DNA? Double-stranded, you got thymine right here. All right, so the helicase unwinds the DNA molecule. And if we want to make another identical copy of this DNA, how many strands are we going to end up with? Okay, we're going to end up with two strands down here, right? But they're double-stranded themselves. All right, so this thing is unzipped. The DNA polymerase then takes a deoxyribonucleotide and base pairs it properly. Well, this guanine right here, base pair with adenine, new, but it will with cytosine, right? So that's kind of handy. We don't have like little taxi molecules bringing these nucleotides in like we do for translation where they bring in amino acids. It's just done by diffusion. All right, so there's probably two different colors. I hope there's two different colors right here. The old DNA strand is, does it like light blue? How's that? Does light blue work? It's pink. Oh, okay, pink. Okay, so pink here and pink here, right? All right, so that's the old DNA strand. All right, so it unzips, and does that old strand ever come apart? It's always continuous, right? It unzips, all right, but the primary structure or the primary sequence of these nucleotides never gets rearranged, so it doesn't change the definition of the gene or how to build a protein, right? It just unzips. And then the old strand is used as a template to make, right, a complementary strand. Again, that's going to be DNA because I can see thymines right in here. Now, what about this new strand? Is that a different color? I'm hoping it is. Purple, which is like a dark pink. Not even, huh? Okay. Okay, so here is the new strand. All right, so notice that the old strand never breaks apart. So we got half of the old double helix over here, half of the other old double helix over here. It never breaks apart. But you get a new strand on each of the old parts of the double helix. So you get two copies of what you started with, one copy of DNA. Now you've got two copies of DNA right here. All right, and this process of making a new copy of DNA, meaning having a high degree of fidelity because the old DNA never breaks apart. So the old DNA is used as a template to make a new copy of the DNA. So this is why we call this semi-conservative. Semi-conservative meaning that each new DNA molecule is half what? Old DNA and new DNA. So it's semi-conservative. It's not fully conservative. If it was, you'd end up with one complete old DNA molecule and one complete new one. All right, so that's why it works so well, because the old DNA is never broken down. Okay, so here we have a process of reproduction. And there's a couple different kinds of reproduction taking place. All right. In us, but here is one form of reproduction. Good, it's a dark enough marker. Here's a cell, and where do you have chromosomes inside the cell? Yeah, it's inside the nucleus. Remember, chromosomes never leave the nucleus when it's there. And in the human, how many chromosomes are there? Okay, it's not important necessarily for this class, but a biology class you'd really want to know. There are 46. Okay, so there are 46. But in particular, there's a special arrangement of 46 chromosomes. Okay, does anybody know something about these 46? Where do they come from? Okay, so there are two sets, right? There's actually two sets. So here's one set, Here's another set, and we can split them in half. There's a number one, a number two, a number three. These carry different genes, they are different sizes, so number one is a lot different than number two, which is a lot different than number three, all the way down to number 23 down over here. Then you got another set. One, two, be nice if I had another colored pen or pencil. Three. This number one and this number one are very similar. They might carry different characteristics, but at least they're very similar. For instance, maybe this one will carry information about your hair color, and the same one over here. Right, but this one might say, well, you should have black hair, but this one over here says you should have yellow hair. All right, but it's still what? Hair color information. But these genes and these other chromosomes will carry information for other kinds of traits. Now, for instance, hair color, all the way down to what? 23 over here. All right, so why do you have two sets? What's a really nice, simple way of thinking of that? Because you got a mom and a dad, right? Or at least at one point in time, you had a mom and a dad. Maybe you don't have a mom and a dad right now, but sometime you had both a mom and a dad. Even if you're a test tube baby, you had a mom and a dad. Okay, we haven't really figured out how to do it, but that probably will be soon. Okay, is there a test tube baby in here? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to. Okay, so these over here, okay, so these are, for instance, the maternal chromosomes that you get from your mom, right, and these over here are the papa chromosomes, right? But if these are maternal, what would you call these? Paternal, right? All right, so you have two sets, and then these come together. Oh, what kind of cell carries one set of chromosomes? Okay? Some people produce these things. Other people produce things like that. Okay? And you got to know something about that little thing out there for the test. Okay? So this is a sperm, right? So here we got 23 chromosomes. Here is another one. This is what we call an egg. So we got an egg, right? And a sperm over here. Right? And there's 23 chromosomes. These can fuse together. We're going to get to mitosis in just a second. These things can fuse together to form this cell that has 46 chromosomes. What do we call that process right there? Before you took this class, everybody knows. That's what? What is that? That is... Okay, I'm not quite sure I heard it. That's fertilization, okay? So we're taking genes from different organisms, right, two different people, putting them together to create what? A new kind of life form right here through the process of what? Fertilization, okay. And then you might have to know what this single cell is called. What is a single cell called? Anybody know? That's a zygote. So here's a zygote right here. And we were all a zygote at one time. Not a very interesting stage in our life, because why? Can't go to physiology class, right? Can't go to lab. No practicums or nothing. All right, so here you are as a zygote, but in order to have fun, what do you have to be? Got to protect your ears a little bit. Let's turn that mic down a little bit, like that. You've got to... to die hard with this microphone. Okay, you've got to do what? You got to get big. You got to grow up, right, to have fun. All right, so there's actually two sets of chromosomes right here. So we call this condition diploid. Actually, I don't want to go into that. What I do want to talk about is how you go from this stage to being trillions of cells right here. All right, and let's think of the initial process, mitosis. Alright, that cell is going to split into two cells. These are what your book calls. We saw it in the slides already, daughter cells. These are daughter cells. And how many chromosomes are going to be in these daughter cells? Yeah, it's going to be 46, exactly the same number. Because this is who you are. We don't want to change who you are by just getting big. Okay? All right, so we want to learn something about mitosis. So mitosis is a form of reproduction. And it would have been really nice if I had another color pen. I could have made this one a blue one or... But, oh, it's the same color. We'll use that concept. Huh? I got a red one down there. But actually, I like the concept of just using this nice black marker right here. So what's the difference between these two daughter cells? What about the number of chromosomes? Exactly the same, okay? And what about the color?
Same.
Exactly the same. Same. So really, what is the difference between these two daughter cells, as I've shown it here on the board? And in real life, there's no difference between them. They're like clones, right? And what's the difference between this daughter cell and this cell right over here, which we said was a zygote, but in general, let's just call this a parent cell. What's the difference between a parent cell and a daughter cell? How many chromosomes? Same. What's the color? The same. So these daughter cells are basically a clone of this cell right here. So mitosis, right, is a form of reproduction, but it produces the same thing over and over and over again. All right, so we call that asexual reproduction. All right, now if you turn around and look at everybody in the room, do you see another you? Do you see a clone of yourself? So how were we all produced? Were we produced by a process of mitosis, asexual reproduction? No, through a process called sexual reproduction, which does what? Produces something different all the time, all right? But we're interested just in mitosis. So mitosis is reproduction. You should know two important reasons for mitosis. It's not to produce new individuals, but to do what? Maybe I hear something. One word. Say one. One word.
Diversity.
Diversity, not for mitosis. Diversity because what? It produces the same thing over and over again, which is not diversity. But if you look around the room, you see diversity. That is sexual reproduction. But this is before we get to sexual reproduction. That's like the last week of the class. That's how I keep everybody coming to class through the whole semester. Mitosis, asexual reproduction. Because you were just a single cell at one time, but now you're big, right? So growth is an important function for mitosis. So growth is one reason for mitosis. All right, but I want to know at least one more besides growth. Yeah, repair. Repair old and damaged cells, because the cells that you have in your body are not the ones that you had last week, okay, probably even this morning, certainly not 5 years ago. As a matter of fact, 5 years ago, you had a totally different skeleton. It's been rebuilt, all right? So you're a very active organism, changing things all the time. And when we get to blood, we'll see that red blood cells live for a very short period of time, only about 120 days, and then they die. They don't repair themselves very well. Right. What do you call that condition when you run out of red blood cells because maybe too many die? That's called? Yeah, sickle cell anemia will produce that condition. Okay. Sickle cell anemia will produce an anemia. So when you run low on red blood cells, you become anemic. Right. And so if red blood cells only live for about 120 days, that means a lot are going to die every day in your body. But a better way to think about it, how many die every second? Okay, I know the answer, that's why I'm asking you. So I don't know if you know or not, but it's a lot. It's about 2 million. Okay, 2 million red blood cells in your body die every second. So in order for you not to become anemic, how many does your body have to build every second? Yeah, 2 million. It seems like a lot to me. So it's busy undergoing what kind of process? Mitosis, to replace those cells. So to do what? Growth is one, and then the second one is to do what? Replace old and damaged cells. And all of your red blood cells that you have in your body should be, you know, basically identical, similar. All right, replace old or damaged cells. Huh? This process right here is a part of sexual reproduction. So I just kind of wanted to show you something about these chromosomes right here, because we talked about replication. Okay? And so the reason why I just introduced this is because I see 46 here, and I see 46 here, and 46 here. So how could you have 46 here and then split apart and still end up with 46? Because something has to happen before mitosis takes place. And that is DNA replication. Okay? So in this stage, right here, a cell is going to have just a nice, you know, double-stranded chromosome right here. We can't split that in half to put in daughter cells. What do we want? We want one here, exactly like it. Well, it can't be in the cytoplasm. Sorry about that. Where's it got to be? Inside the nucleus? getting complicated. And there's got to be one down over here as well, right? All right, so this simple chromosome over here has to be replicated, and when it does, remember, it belongs inside the nucleus, it forms something like this structure right here. These are, we call that a chromosome, but what is it really? It's a replicated chromosome. There are actually two copies of that chromosome joined together to form that like X structure right there. So that when mitosis takes place, what happens? These things split apart and end up in these two different cells. Okay, so replicate, DNA replication has to start first. All right. Most cells of the body are an interphase. They're non-dividing. It's not really an active part of mitosis. But what happens during interphase? It gets ready, cells get ready for mitosis by what? DNA replication. And if there is one of these organelles inside the cell before mitosis, okay, then you would have one organelle in the other cell and one would get shipped out of one. So what has to happen to this thing? What is this that I just drew on the board? A nice mitochondria. So the organelles have to replicate themselves before mitosis takes place. And what phase of the cell cycle do these organelles replicate themselves? Interphase as well. Okay, so interphase is a phase before mitosis. All right, so here is a nice diagram that shows the whole cell cycle. And the longest part of the cell cycle is interphase. So this is all interphase right through here. And what's taking place? Oh, centrioles replicate. What's a centriole? It's a kind of organelle. All right, and then in the middle part of interphase, we have DNA replication going from a chromosome that has just one simple double helix into what? Two that are attached together in the center right here. And then there's another phase of interphase. It's the final growth phase, and the cell just checks to make sure that it has everything it needs to divide before it divides, because once it divides, it can't go back. Okay, and so this is interphase, the longest phase right here. And then the cell goes into mitosis. Here are the four phases of active mitosis: prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. Right, and I'm sure that you all in anatomy or biology learned this funny little word right here, right? IPMAT. Kind of in your mind, just say IPMAT. That stands for the whole cell cycle. The first phase of mitosis is prophase, right? So this letter right here represents the first letter of the phase of mitosis, prophase, and then metaphase, which is middle phase, anaphase, and telophase. And take a wild guess what telo means. End. It's the end of what's happening, right? So telo is the end of something. Interphase is the longest growth phase, or is the longest phase. And how would you characterize interphase? As being phase for replication or growth of all these components inside the cell. All right, so I don't think I'm going to ask you about any of these subdivisions of interphase. Did you have any questions at the end of the book or online questions? You had a couple? Okay, which was what? DNA replication? S is DNA replication? Okay, that's not bad. So don't forget, before mitosis can take place, if you want daughter cells with the identical number of chromosomes, what has to happen first before mitosis? Replication, DNA replication has to take place first. So that's not a bad thing to know about. Okay, here's that chromosome. And you can see this thing underneath a light microscope, because what kind of chromatin is this? This is condensed chromatin. Can it be used for transcription? No, it can't. All right. So here you have that long filamentous molecule, which is extended, right? And in mitosis, it starts to condense like this, and it becomes protected, right? It can't be, because you don't want to chop this DNA molecule anywhere, because then those genes are useless. The cell is going to die. All right. So here is a chromatid. Sometimes we call these daughter chromatids right here. They're connected at the centromere. And it's a protected form of DNA. Now, when the cell is in interphase right here, actively working, the chromatin is extended. What's protecting all the extended chromatin inside the nucleus? Yeah, the nuclear envelope, right? But during mitosis, that nuclear envelope is going to disappear, So the cell has figured out to package it in condensed chromatin to keep it from being destroyed. So here are those four stages. You should know some concise events that happen during these different phases. Right, prophase is when extended chromatin condenses. Metaphase is when all the chromosomes line up at the equator of the cell. Well, let's go back to prophase a little bit. Prophase, chromatin condenses. The nuclear envelope disappears. Right, so now the DNA is in jeopardy of being destroyed, but it's protected how? It's made into a chromosome, right? It's condensed. The spindle apparatus, that means that the centrioles, and I have a couple pictures of centrioles, start to arrange microtubules inside the cell and attach themselves to the chromosomes when they're condensing. And what's the job of those microtubules and microfilaments there? They're like little monorails. They can move chromosomes around inside the cell. So they attach, and then they move all the chromosomes so they line up right on the equator of the cell. And when that happens, we call that metaphase. All right, so they're attached to the spindle apparatus, which is made up of these spindle fibers, which are the microtubules. And then, right, the chromatids start to separate. That's anaphase. When the sister, actually they're called daughter chromatids then, after they start to separate, when they're pulled to the opposite ends of the cell, right, then we have telophase. During telophase, then the two daughter cells start to develop, and the nuclear envelope starts to form once again, and the chromatin goes from the chromosome back to an extended form so that it can be used. So here we have interphase. Maybe I see some nucleoli inside the nucleus, but this is what kind of phase of the cell cycle? It just, the interphase, right? But what, in general, what would you think of interphase? A growth phase. And maybe another way to think about growth phase, let's say that this is an endocrine cell secreting a hormone. What phase of the cell cycle is that cell going to be in when it's secreting a hormone? You could think of it as like being a growth phase, because it's doing what? It's building new protein molecules or steroid molecules for secretion, right? So that's going to be interphase. But when it's time to divide, this nuclear envelope is going to disappear, chromatin is going to condense, and these centrioles are going to migrate to opposite poles of the cell. Spindle fibers will develop. Clearly, this is metaphase. Nice, mature, fully developed spindle apparatus. You can see it nicely even on the micrograph right here. And now I can see, which used to be sister chromatids, right? Chromosomes joined together. I can see the daughter chromatids now forming because the sisters are being pulled apart. They become individual chromosomes by themselves. We call those daughter chromatids. I see a dropout of signal right here. So that tells me it's anaphase. And then I can see now two daughter cells developing during telophase because the cells start to pinch apart. And again, it's the microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell that can be attached to the plasma membrane that cause this process to happen. And then the cytoplasm is separated into two daughter cells during telophase. And that has a name too. We call that cytokinesis. So the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells is cytokinesis. And I want you to know what phase of mitosis does cytokinesis take place. I want a nice, simple understanding of that, and I want you to say telophase. But you might say, oh, but look at this diagram over here. Okay. On this diagram, I see that it happens after telophase is complete. Okay. But we don't really consider cytokinesis a separate phase, even though this diagram kind of shows it as a separate phase outside of telophase. All right. So, indeed, cytokinesis in certain cells, in certain animals, under certain conditions, might actually begin in anaphase, and it might end in telophase. All right? But in this particular class, I want you to say that cytokinesis takes place in telophase. Let's make it simple. Okay? So I'm sure scientists and everybody else will be discussing when cytokinesis, when does it begin, when does it stop, probably for the next 100 or 200 years, but I got to grade your tests before 100 years. Right? So Let's just say in here, cytokinesis takes place in telophase. More importantly, I want you to know what cytokinesis is. And that is what? The separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. But in a understanding, what is mitosis? What's the difference between mitosis and cytokinesis? Mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two separate daughter cells, but cytokinesis is what? The separation of cytoplasm, in particular, into two daughter cells. So that's the distinction I want you to make. Okay. So here are these centrioles. These organize the microtubule system in different stages of the cell cycle for what? For transport, but also for cell structure, or cell shape might be a better way of saying that. It helps determine where microtubules and microfilaments go, helps determine what kind of shape the cell is going to have, whether a cell is a shapeshifter. Do you have a good shapeshifter cell in mind? What kind of cell can change shape inside your body? Like a white blood cell, okay? Like a monocyte that's in your blood can change its shape, can become really thin, squeeze out of a capillary and can crawl around through all the interstitial spaces of your body, even inside the alveoli, inside your lungs, looking for things that don't belong in your body, phagocytizes them, gets rid of them. All right, so it moves around by diapedesis, kind of like an amoeba, one of the few cells that can actually do that in your body. But most cells have a kind of standard shape. All right, the telomeres are the ends. Let's look at a chromosome again. Are the ends of a chromosome. So here is a telomere right here, and a telomere, and a telomere. When a cell undergoes mitosis, it loses some base pairs off of these telomeres. So every time a cell undergoes mitosis, what happens to this chromosome? It gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. All right, so eventually that cell line is going to die because the chromosomes get too short. And that's a normal process of controlling the kinds of cells and how they develop inside the human body. All right, so when that happens, that's the end of that particular cell line. All right, so then we say that cell becomes senescent. So we believe then that as these telomeres disappear, that's kind of like a molecular clock for aging of that particular kind of cell line. But not all cells are subject to that kind of deactivation. There are certain cells that have an enzyme called telomerase, which can rebuild those segments that are lost. And that cell line can live on forever and ever and ever. That might sound like a good thing. But what happens if you have a cell that all of a sudden decides to go through this process of mitosis very rapidly, right, and it rebuilds its telomeres so that that cell line never dies? What's going to happen then? It forms a tumor someplace in your body, okay? And if that tumor then, if those cells can break away from that site and go to other places in your body and form tumors, you know, that's what we call cancer. Then that's a metastasis. And it can just take over your body and cause all kinds of problems. All right, so most cell lines are nicely controlled. All right, but some have telomerase. Oh, it even says cancer cells right here. So there are some cells that kind of divide forever, like the cells that produce these gametes right here, or other kinds of stem cells in your body have telomerase. But it's kind of always, what, a iffy proposition. If cells are told to grow and grow and grow and grow indefinitely without the proper controls. All right, meiosis. We're not going to cover on this particular test, so I'm not going to go over meiosis. But meiosis is a process that produces a sperm and an egg. And I do want you to know what is a general term for a sperm and an egg. These are what we call gametes, all right? These are gametes, so you have male gametes and female gametes. Well, not everybody does. You either have one or the other, right? Okay, and what's an important distinction between a gamete and all the other cells in your body? A gamete only has half the number of chromosomes, all right? So the process of taking a normal cell in your body and converting it into a gamete, cutting the number of chromosomes in half, that's what we call meiosis. All right, and hopefully we'll get to that a little bit later. So it's a nuclear reduction process. But mitosis does what? Keeps the number of chromosomes exactly the same. All right, so we'll look at meiosis a little bit later, probably when we get into the diversification chapter. Okay, So that's it for the test. Now, are there any questions regarding the test? Ah, yeah, I've got some things. You need a Scantron. The regular 884E or 884ES. I'd stay away. Is it an 882? Does anybody have one? Did I maybe had 884 in the syllabus. Uh-oh. That one right there, what does it say? 882. Okay, good thing we're recording this. 882 is what you need. It's got 100 questions on it. It's got a front and a back. And stay away from the LOVAS, 882 LOVAS, because it has the bubbles already kind of filled in with a shaded color, and the Scantron reader has problems with that. You need a picture ID, Cypress or Fullerton College picture ID, a pencil, and a good eraser. I couldn't tell that they were different colors. So there's a red one and a green one? There are. Yeah, 882E or ES, but not LOVAS. There's another one called LOVAS that I do not like. 882 LOVAS. Don't get that one. Take your pencil, make a mark on a clean piece of paper, then take your eraser and erase that mark. If it doesn't erase the mark, then throw the eraser away, right? Because you'll get gypped out of points on the test. Check that out ahead of time. And you'll have until 12:50 to complete the test on Tuesday. And your calculators. Yeah, calculators. Basic scientific calculator, non-graphing. Hi. Yeah, I did. Nice to see you. Let me turn all these microphones off.